Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 375th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor at the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and a professor at the University of Alberta.
And this is the second podcast where we are high.
Yes, that's right. High on life, James.
Yeah, what did you think I meant?
I barely understand what you mean at the best of
times. I know, yes. So for those of you who follow along and listen to these podcasts, you know we're doing a discussion of sort of medical cannabis. Sounds like I'm stoned already. Medical cannabis or medical marijuana. And in our previous podcast, Mike did an excellent job of going over the best available evidence. And we'll give a synopsis of just that in just a minute. And what we're talking about is how do you, there's so many different products that are available. I mean, we talked about there's liquid tinctures, you can vaporize it, patches, eating it, capsules, and so on. And I don't think we talked much about it in the previous podcast, but the two active ingredients are known as THC and CBD. And Mike, correct me if I am wrong, but those are the potential active ingredients that are in most of the prescription or if you will, pharmaceutical versions of medical marijuana.
Yeah, absolutely. So nabilone, THC,
yeah.
And nabiximols are a mix of yeah. CBD and THC.
Yeah, and dronabinol is also THC.
Yeah, and yeah. So a lot of these are the medical derived or the pharmaceutically derived ones are really trying to capture those two components primarily.
Yeah.
And as people have begun to realize that CBD has actions on pain and maybe anxiety and a bunch yeah. of other things, they've tried to bring in more of the CBD component and move away from THC. But it doesn't free you up entirely from some of the hazards associated with either side.
Yeah. Yeah, no, exactly. And when it comes to smoking it, I mean, a cannabis plant really has, from what I've read, is about 400 different chemicals in it, of which
yes, exactly.
about 70 are cannabinoids. So, you know, you're getting something subtly different when you actually smoke it than if you use the pharmaceutical version of it. I'm not suggesting one is better than the other, but they are quite different.
Yeah. It turns out their effects we haven't been able to determine if they're measurably different, and the mm-hmm. adverse events turn out to be very similar as well, but maybe not perfectly similar. So yeah. Let's talk a little bit about what we found for the adverse events. And I'm going to say right up front, one of our challenges with adverse events is how they're reported within the systematic reviews. Mm-hmm. And what we did in this case is a little different, is we decided that we would focus very specifically on only adverse events that had been meta-analyzed. So why would we do that? It was because there was so many. And so we wanted to narrow it down into being able to kind of give some numeric values for adverse events. When it really doesn't matter, once you look at RCTs, you're not going to look at a lot of the more serious things that you hear talked about with medical marijuana. So, or medical cannabinoids. Mm-hmm. And those are outbreaks of psychosis or schizophrenia, things like the addictions issues, and the other ones, or a cannabis use disorder, if you like, that's the correct mm-hmm. term now. And lastly, the cyclic vomiting syndrome that can occur with chronic use of cannabinoids. That is in the literature. It's not... We are still actually waiting for more robust information about that, and it's still being delineated. So we're really what we're focusing on here are the ones in clinical trials.
Right.
So and
which are much more acute adverse
right.
events,
right.
and don't in any way, shape, or form deal with, you know, the cannabis use disorders or cancer or anything like that.
Right. Or so. Yeah. Exactly. Does smoking marijuana daily lead to an increased risk of lung cancer? Well, it's not going to be teased out here. And interestingly, mm-hmm. when you look at the data for that, you can find studies that show an increased risk, but you can also find studies that didn't find much of an increased risk. So these are cohort studies. And we just felt that to focus the systematic review down, we would rely on RCTs and meta-analysis of those RCTs. So let's jump into it. If you had to guess kind of an overall risk of developing an adverse event associated with the use of medical cannabinoids, you would say your risk was about 20% higher. So if you looked at the placebo rates in most of these studies, about 60% of people report some adverse event versus about 80% of people report some adverse event in the cannabinoid group. Mm-hmm. So, and some are higher. The rates are, for example, 92% versus 78%, but the and then some go down as low as 79 versus 56. But the important thing is that it is higher relatively consistently. Number needed to treat somewhere around 6 there.
You mean number needed to harm?
Number needed to harm. Thank you. Yeah. Number needed to treat to harm.
Yes.
So, and then we looked at serious adverse events. And as you know, James, these are ones that end you up in hospital, end up in death, those kind of things. And one group broke them down into patient years and found there were 0.4 versus 0.25 or so. It didn't reach statistical significance. Really, none of these, a couple of them, Whiting in their meta-analysis with 34 RCTs reported an odds ratio of 1.41 that was statistically significant, meaning the odds increased by about 40%, but that is hard to interpret. And so we didn't, and they didn't provide the actual numbers. Mm-hmm. So we can't really fill you in there. But the risk differences in one study was reported as about 1%, again, not statistically significant. So why would there just be a signal of maybe something going on? Because these trials are short and all of those kind of things. It's hard. Serious adverse events is a higher bar. And a lot of these patients aren't at risk for serious adverse events, they're younger, that kind of thing.
Yeah,
or less
so,
risk.
So serious adverse events are typically described as, you know, things that require hospitalization, you know, things that have significant morbidity associated with them and so on. Whereas almost all the adverse events that we're going to be talking about with medical cannabinoids are really to do with the actual acute ingestion of the active ingredient.
Right. And so let's talk about withdrawals due to adverse events. I always find this is a good marker of how tolerable a drug mm-hmm. is. And so when you look at the information, Whiting reports an odds ratio of around 3. The relative risks that we calculated were kind of 2 to 3. And many of the others went as high as a 7. And that was one with where the withdrawal rate was only 1% in the placebo, but 14% in the treatment arm. And it ranged from all the way from a 1% withdrawal rate from placebo to about 11%. And then in the cannabinoid group, it ranged all the way from 4% all the way up to 15. But overall, if you had to guess, you'd be talking about 5 to 10% of patients will drop out due to adverse events associated with the use of cannabinoids.
And if you remember back to the previous, if you're using it, for instance, for pain, we're talking about 1 in 10 people will get a probably clinically important benefit from a pain perspective. So there's a balance between that. So as many people who are will have to stop it get a benefit. And then the important thing to remember is they are not necessarily the same people.
Yeah, absolutely. So the people getting benefit might be getting benefit without any of the adverse events that they would consider intolerable or even bad.
Yeah.
For example, if a patient has pain and has trouble sleeping and decided to use medical cannabinoids at bedtime to help them sleep and combine that kind of sedation effect, they might actually, the adverse event might be something positive for them.
Exactly.
If you will. Yeah. So let's talk about that. That's one of the number one adverse events, sedation. And when you're looking at it, the number needed to harm there is somewhere around 5. If we look at the biggest mm-hmm. studies where we can actually get real numbers, it's about 1,400 patients. about 50% will feel sedated versus 30% on placebo. That number needed to harm is 5. If we're looking at now, we included on here the sensation of feeling high, and some people will say that is not an adverse event. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, it is. The way you look at clinical trials information is when you design a study to get a positive effect in an area that the patient is suffering from, and something else happens to them, even if, as I mentioned, it's sedation and that's a positive thing, then you still count the sedation as the side effect, even though it might be positive. So, for example, in the recent study of canakinumab, I think it was, for heart disease, they found a reduction in arthritis. Mm-hmm. And that was reported as an adverse event. And so when we look at these things, we report them as, and I'm in, you know, air quotes, adverse events, but some people may rebut that, but still within a clinical trial framework, we would call these not something that you intended to get and therefore an adverse effect.
Yeah, and some people might like the feeling high thing and others may not.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And what was that? Well, in the smaller ones, it was as high as 70%. And in the ones where with the most patients, about 1,000 patients, it was 35% who reported feeling high versus 3% in placebo. Number needed to harm there is 4. And then dysphoria. So we always think of euphoria and feeling high, but actually some patients who smoke cannabis or actually take the medicines have a dysphoric feeling. And the number needed to harm there is around 8 for about 13% versus about 0.3%. Groups of studies with about 700 patients. To counter that, euphoria is about is very similar numbers. So where dysphoria was 13 and 0.3, euphoria is 15 and 2%. So very similar number needed to harm of around 9. And I don't think we need to go through them all, James, but you know, I think we need to hit on some of the key ones. And it's unfortunate. So blurred vision and visual hallucinations are grouped together. And mm-hmm. I would say those are not the same thing.
They are subtly different.
Yeah. So, yeah. And this is one of the challenges in adverse event reporting. So we're going to give you numbers of kind of 6% versus 0. Mm-hmm. And in the bigger ones that provide actual numbers for us, but how much of that is actual visual hallucinations versus blurred vision?
Yeah, really, it's tricky. Know. But there's also another, one of the adverse events is dissociation or acute psychosis. And one could argue maybe that would pick it up as well a little bit. But again, it's almost impossible to know.
Yeah. And so that one was about 5% versus 0. Number needed to harm there is 20. What's important to note here is one of these authors actually delved deeper into this data and found that the risk of having an acute psychosis episode is higher in naive users. Mm-hmm. And just for the very reasons we talked about on the last podcast. So if I'm a regular user and I've had acute psychosis or disassociation, I'm less likely to want to keep using. Where people who have used and avoid those adverse events are more likely to be comfortable using. And so that's why you're going to see, and other people have suggested, the adverse event profile in medical cannabinoids is a best case scenario mm-hmm. for naive users. Yeah. So, and then there's other things like disorientation. We're talking about 9% versus 2% or something in that kind of range. If we're talking about things like trouble speaking clearly, you and I may fit into this, James. It's 32% versus 7%. Impaired memory is 11 versus 2. Disturbance in paying attention or disconnected thoughts is 17 versus 2%. A lot of this has to do with the known psychotropic effects of cannabinoids. So none of this should come as a great surprise to us. And some patients can turn this into a positive. Again, one of my patients who uses it talks about how he only uses it before bed, and it kind of, because his mind is very restless from a condition I'm not going to say, but he uses this and he finds it calms him down and helps him sleep at night, and it treats his pain problem. So it's kind of it's a multiple win for him. The other ones that I think are worth noting that we often don't think about are dizziness and hypotension. So dizziness is increased in a couple studies. They weren't significant, but in the study by Wade, which was looking at patients with primarily with MS, it was 32% versus 11%. And if you look at hypotension, it's 25% versus 11%. So, you know, so, I think there is a, yeah, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, it's very clear, this, cannabinoids have an effect.
Yes, you know, they do.
Not only from, because, you know, if you were to think, there is not a single medication that would probably make it on the market if it had this number of side effects, which is an interesting concept.
Yeah, it's interesting how many, and this is one of the ways we hear back from people who are frustrated with our reports, like via Twitter and that kind of thing, or sometimes emails, is they're very angry at the fact that we're reporting there are adverse events, which is interesting to me. All I'm reporting is the research studies, but it makes some people very frustrated.
Yeah. And like we've said, we're not even suggesting that all of these side effects are bad. I mean, sedation may be good. Feeling high may be good. You know, I doubt hypotension, most people would think, would be good. And certainly, you know, if you say euphoria, that is, by definition, it's good.
You know? Yeah. So it's, yeah, it's fascinating how, like you said, some people will not feel good feeling high, but virtually everyone, I can't imagine, by the very meaning of the word, euphoria means good.
Yeah.
But dysphoria is equally as common. That's what's fascinating.
Yeah, yeah.
With the product. And so advocacy for this has to be also take into account that not everyone will respond the same way. This is a very distinct compound. And as you said, it's a compound that has been used recreationally. Mm-hmm. It's in a class like alcohol. It's in a class like opioids that can be used recreation. There are lots of other drugs that can be taken recreationally. Certainly we know gabapentin's one and that kind of thing. But this is a little bit separate from that. It's more in the class of drugs that are traditionally used recreationally. And we have to take that into consideration. Doesn't mean that we dismiss it,
no.
But we have to take it into consideration when reflecting on the balances of risks and benefits for this product.
And you know, many of these side effects and are very dose related, and you also develop tolerance to some of them, and we'll talk a lot about that, I think, when we talk about, you know, the guideline about how do you take all of this evidence and put it to use in real medical practice, because I don't think we're going to say we're not going to say these drugs don't work or that they shouldn't be used. It's how do we use this evidence, and hopefully we'll come up with some useful tips and suggestions for how to use these potential products.
Right, and so we'll just run through now really briefly going over it all from the systematic review. And what we want to say is this is the kind of, when we looked at it as a group, we did a grade evaluation of the evidence. And for a 30% reduction in pain, and again, this is focused on neuropathic pain and maybe a little bit with the cancer palliative pain, the relative risk was 1.37. The number needed to treat is somewhere between 10, 11 kind of framework is what you're looking at. And the overall rating of the evidence was very low. And the reason was the serious inconsistency, the lack of precision in the estimate, and then all of the kind of things that we've talked about with blinding and all of that. When you look at nausea and vomiting, it was rated as moderate quality evidence for the placebo versus placebo. And it had some imprecision to it for sure, but it had a large magnitude of effect. So we felt more comfortable rating it as moderate. For spasticity, the rating was low. There was, again, some publication bias risk there and some other risks of bias, but not rated as very low, rated as low for the 30% improvement. And then adverse events, the rating there was considered high. There was concern with risk of bias and the design of the studies and that kind of thing. But the magnitude of the effect was consistently quite large. And the confounding, which means that the people who were enrolled in these studies, a lot of the times were already users of cannabinoids, and therefore we should have seen a reduction in the adverse events. So it should have pushed the adverse event rate down.
Yeah.
Go ahead, James. I was just going to say, so when you take that into account in a grade situation, you end up, even though the evidence was downgraded for a couple reasons, it was upgraded again for the differences in confounding. The confounding should have made less adverse events, and we still found quite a few. So we felt that this is a conservative estimate rather than an overestimation.
And so just a quick synopsis of those side effects, and people have to realize this is above placebo. This is not, and I think it's really important that people realize that. So you're roughly looking at, if you use these agents, about 20 to 30% of people will feel sedated, feeling high, dizzy, or have speech disorders. And then in the 10 to 20% range, ataxia, muscle twitching, low blood pressure, euphoria, dysphoria. About 5 to 10% of people will complain of impaired memory and actually will stop the medications due to side effects. And about 5% will have issues of either dissociation or acute psychosis. So those are real side effects, if you will. And they need to be balanced. And in fact, as we talked about, some of these side effects may be the reason why the product works. So we're not saying that these are necessarily always bad, but those are the sorts of ballpark numbers based on the best available evidence. And then knowing all of this evidence, you can then start to help people make decisions about whether or not this is something that they should even try. And I think we'll get to that in the next podcast, right?
Yeah, we're going to go through the guideline itself and talk about the processes for the guideline, what it's missing, what it's got, those kind of things. And we'll talk about how you actually prescribe it.
Yeah. So what you have so far in these two podcasts is the best available evidence, and hopefully I don't think much was missed, and this is a very difficult area to meta-analyze, put in the information together. And like I said, we're not dealing with any of the legal issues, we're not none of that. And so anything else you want to add, Mike?
No, I think that's good. I'm glad we got a chance to give the data on the four main areas we looked at. Mm-hmm. We'll talk about some of the other things like anxiety next podcast, just to let you know where the evidence deficits are. Mm-hmm. But that's where the best evidence is. And you saw, if you listened to both podcasts, that there is quite a bit of data for those specific conditions. Like neuropathic pain, there is a lot of RCTs. They're not all great quality, but we have enough, I would say, to make a reasonable call of whether or not and how to use them.
Yeah. And so, as we've talked about before, we need to treat this as a medication. And now some people are saying, well, and I'm sure you've read about it, well, it's natural. Or, it comes from a plant. Well, there are hundreds of medications that come from plants. I mean, I'm just trying to think of some. Colchicine, digoxin, levodopa, morphine, quinidine, reserpine.
Aspirin.
Yeah, exactly. So just because it comes from a plant and it is, in quotation, air quotes, natural, doesn't make it necessarily better or safer. It needs to be evaluated exactly in the same way that any other medication or treatment would be evaluated. And fortunately, there are studies, and now you guys know the best available evidence. So I think we'll just leave it at that. So thanks, as always, for listening.
Talk to you later.